The reason why this topic came about was because of Stacy. Stacy mentioned it last spring sometime. She thought this would be a fantastic topic for us to discuss, and the timing just wasn't right to do it in the spring, so here we are. And so over the years that, you know, that Jim and I have been pastoring, a lot has changed in terms of who we're ministering to and the needs of the people in the church and just in the community in general. And I've used this term several times, but sometimes it feels like we're almost a trauma center. People come in here and they're almost bleeding, and we're just trying to stop the hemorrhaging and help them get to a place where they can find healing and help. But the good news is that they're coming to the church. They're coming to us in a time of crisis. And so one of the things that is a challenge for us, though, is to send them to the right place and make sure that we're caring for all of their needs and such. And so what I just wanted to do is open the door to discussing this topic of mental health, because there's so many barriers that seem to prevent us from doing that, whether that's, you know, shame, or we're we're just uncomfortable, or we think that we're going to be judged, or maybe we're judging. You know, you can find yourself anywhere in that spectrum. And so we just want to get it all out on the table. We want you to know that this is a safe place. If you know of someone that's struggling, or if you're struggling with any issues, this is a place where you can come and we can help you find healing. And so I have invited a panel of guests, and they're gonna share their expertise in this area. And I don't think any of them would say they know it all. In fact, I probably know that they'd say that they don't know it all, but they can help you go to people who do know more than them, and they can also help in certain situations as well. And so I'm gonna start down there, so y'all can pick up your microphones. So I have Shireen Howard, and she is a licensed professional counselor. Just pull it. Yep. You just gotta yank it. There you go. She was the former director at Friends of the Family. They're ran their battering intervention program. Is that how that?
Correct.
Yep. And she recently retired from the Denton County Sheriff's Office, where she was a counselor for the inmates there at the Denton County Jail. And I probably left off a whole bunch. And so can you just give me an elevator speech on anything else you'd like to tell them about yourself?
Well, I am went back to school to get my counselor's license. And so it was back about 20 years ago. And I didn't know I wanted to be a counselor. But through the process, and I guess God sent me here and here and here, and I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. This is very cool. So I've spent 20 years doing counseling, and when I went to the jail, that there was a lot of issues that came up, and I know that a lot of grief and things like that, and also I know that there's spirituality, and they had time to read the Bible and all that, and so I decided to look into more biblical counseling, and believe it or not, there's conferences with biblical counselors and what to do, and they just cover everything, and thought, this is really cool. So I've incorporated the biblical aspect of things into my work and have really enjoyed it. So that's where I'm at now.
Yeah. So this is Tammy, and Tammy is a former pastor's wife and an educator. You retired also, right?
I did.
Yes. An education director or coordinator at the Denton County Jail as well. And so tell us a little bit about your life.
Yeah, so I'm my husband was a minister. He passed away just about 15 years ago, so that's why I'm former. And then I spent a lot of years at the Counseling Center for Denton Bible with Steve Barnes and Associates, so I really got my feet wet with the whole everything from the office supplies to scheduling so I was pretty much the gatekeeper. So when people would call in, I kind of got to field what they really needed, you know, help them kind of analyze who they needed to meet with and what they could do on their own before they got to see a counselor, because a lot of times you don't call and get an appointment the next day. Sometimes there's 2, 3, 4, 6 weeks in between. So so I got to talk to a lot of people and find out ways I could help them just in that intermediate time period where they were waiting to see a counselor. Because a lot of times when people do call in, it is crisis mode. I really enjoyed what I did. And then when my husband passed away, I left that so I could work in the education field with my daughter. And then as she got older, then I got on with the jail and worked with the jail. And then so the education coordinator, the chaplain, and the counselors worked closely together. So that's how Shireen and I met. So, yeah, that's pretty much what I've been doing.
Great. Okay. Mark, last but not least. And Mark is the counseling director, right? That's your title. Counseling director for First Refuge Ministry here in town. And I'm going to let you tell us a little bit about that ministry and what you do. I could say it, but I think you'll do a better job.
Yeah, so my name is Mark. I work as the counseling director here in, this isn't Denton, we're in Sanger. I work as the counseling director in Denton County at First Refuge Ministries. I'm also one of the pastors at Christ Community Church in Denton. And been in pastoral ministry for about 8 years and been working with people who struggle with mental illness and addictions for about 10 years. I also have had a background in addictions and alcohol abuse. So when I was a teenager, I started using drugs, started abusing alcohol, got addicted to crack cocaine when I was 19 years old and was homeless for about 10 years. And came to a ministry called the Denton Freedom House. Maybe any of you guys are familiar with Denton Freedom House. I came in January the 4th, 2009, and Jesus found me in power on January the 6th, 2009. I graduated the program 6 months later, and I was on staff there 8.5 years. I was a pastor of the church for 4 years and was a pastor of the men's home for 5 years. When I resigned there in April of 2017, I went to a pastorate at C3. And then started full-time this year at First Refuge as the counseling director.
So I've had lengthy conversations with all of them several times over the past couple months and been blown away just by the amount of knowledge that all of them have in this area. And so I'm very excited about tonight. But I have a question for you, Shireen. I'm going to start with you. And what is, regarding this topic that we're talking about, what's the difference between, we had kind of talked about this, in terms of mental health issues, like emotional struggles versus just situational struggles that people are going through, maybe hormones, different things. Like what defines those two categories? What makes it a mental issue versus something just situational or hormonal or something?
Okay. Well, the short answer is that if something is affecting you and affecting your life for an extended period of time, then it becomes something that might be problematic and you want to address. If it's, like you said, situational, loss of a husband, loss of a job, anything, it's normal to have grief and feelings of sadness and things like that. But if it starts lasting longer and affects your quality of life and people start to say, hey, are you okay, or and this kind of thing, then you kind of want to maybe ask yourself, is something going on? We can get real technical in terms of definition of what mental illness is. The doctors and diagnostic and statistical manuals have, syndromes and names for a lot of different things, but so hormonal could be just developmentally, teenagers. You could have something going on with your thyroid medically, so that can affect how you feel and things like that. So there's medical things, so you could check out with a doctor. Psychiatric, you could go to a psychiatrist for those kind of things and just kind of go from there. We'll list all those people here in a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and do you have anything to add? Anybody else?
Nope, that's pretty much covers that, Mark.
Yeah, I would just say from a biblical standpoint, mental illness is really just an experience of human suffering. When we think of just human suffering and we see just throughout the narrative of the Bible, suffering, it can be very complex, or it can be very simple. Like, I'm suffering as a result of cancer. I've been diagnosed with cancer. And sometimes mental illness is what you would consider more complex suffering. But from a biblical standpoint, it's really just an experience of human suffering from the psychological sense.
Okay. And so, going off of that, what if it is biblical, you know, that there is human suffering in the Bible, but, you know, what are the underlying, I mean, what are the common underlying issues that cause that? What usually precedes that becoming, and I mean, you said cancer, or I think a minute ago you said death or something like that, but what other things can cause the range of mental, anybody can answer this, of mental illness or challenges?
I think one of the things that tends to get overlooked, especially from a biblical perspective and in Christendom in general, and people are kind of all over the map in this, but working at a center, I would literally have people who would call who would say, I'm bipolar, I'm diagnosed bipolar, but I don't want to take my medication because I should be complete in my Christianity, and Christ completes me. And my quick comeback to that was, if you had a broken arm, would you just wait for God to heal your broken arm, or would you go and get it set? And without a doubt, they would always say, well, I'm going to go get it set. I'm going to get it fixed. Well, it's the same thing with things like when you are diagnosed with a problem, a mental health issue, then you should take steps to get it fixed or get it treated. And that my other example would be that's more ongoing is if you're diabetic. If you're diabetic, are you going to take your insulin? Or are you just going to wait for God to fix it? Is God capable? Absolutely. I would never question that. But we live in a fallen world, and we live in fallen situations, and we cope and handle and manage things as best with the best information that we have. And if I'm diagnosed bipolar, then I need to take my medication that makes me the most normal to everybody else. It doesn't always make me feel normal, but if I present normal to everybody else, then that's the medication that I need.
So sometimes there's past trauma, like, you know, maybe you were in an accident when you were very, very young, and just the things that happened around that, you heard somebody say something, and that stuck in your head, and then now you just have a reaction to that certain situation. So that's not necessarily an illness, but it is affecting your life, and it may be something that you need to go, oh, I need to, you know, what's going on here, and address that. So I have a hard time with labels. Like you said, oh, I'm bipolar or whatever. So it's important not to take a label, whether it's depression or I'm anxious or whatever, as a badge of, you know, to carry around and say, oh, well, that's why I do this or that or the other thing. You know, but it is a tool. It is something to say, well, I need to learn more about this and what can I do?
Yeah, I would even say in regards to labels, diagnoses really describe the symptom, but there is always a person behind it. And so from a biblical standpoint, we are image bearers, that we are made in the image of God. And so oftentimes diagnostics and labels can bear the identity of the individual, when really they're meant to describe the symptoms. Like, these are the symptoms, that's what's going on. But there's to always remember that there is a person behind that, and that is important.
You mentioned something in our meeting last week about post-traumatic stress. I think that's what we talked about, little D disorder. Sure. Can you explain that? I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, so you mentioned biblical counseling conferences. I have been a part of the Association of Biblical Counseling for quite some time now, and they hold a national conference. And it was actually a couple years ago, I was a part of the post-traumatic stress track. And so it was several days where everybody that's at the conference can choose different tracks. So depression, addiction, anxiety, and PTS. And what was interesting is Solomon, he is the director of the Biblical Counseling Coalition, and he did a piece on PTS. And what was funny is in his slideshow, in his PowerPoint, he labeled PTS with a lowercase d to sort of show the disorder, right? And their approach to PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, that from, again, from a biblical framework, how could you be disordered if you are changed by a very traumatic event? That's actually a part of just being normal. Like, it would be disorderly if you were not changed by a traumatic event, right? And so they were kind of just holding that loosely, you know, that the term to be disordered, that if you lost your three-year-old child in a terrible car accident and that that didn't affect you, that might be a disorder. But the fact that you are impacted by that just really speaks to your humanity and the natural response that we have to suffering that sometimes is very altering, life-altering. And so, yeah.
I don't mean to pick on you, but can you, I'm going to throw another one at you, but like what are, I have this question written down, let me see, I'll make sure I get it worded right. So the Bible gives us, I mean, you're talking about, you know, biblical perspectives and that sort of thing, but can you think of any instances in the Bible where some of these issues, you're seeing them kind of in some of our greatest Bible heroes, you know, that maybe they're dealing with some of the same issues that we've dealt with. I mean, I'm thinking your post-traumatic stress that you just talked about, like you could use an example of that or something else.
Yeah, so in James chapter 5, verse 17, James says, Elijah, meaning the prophet Elijah, was a man with a nature just like your own. And what James is getting at is that Elijah, though he was one of the most anointed prophets to ever walk the face of the earth outside of Christ, he was a man that is no different than you or me in his humanity. And in 1 Kings chapter 19, we read in a story of the prophet when having received word from a messenger of Jezebel that she would make his life just like the life of one of the prophets of Baal. And Elijah was full of fear and ran and fled. And then begins to really despair his life, feeling very lonely. Maybe even you could say that there was some sense of hopelessness there. And he began to ask God to take his life. And what we see in the narrative there is someone who is regarded as one of the most godly, most anointed men of God, but yet struggling with such a despair that he asked God to take his life. And so James is trying to draw a connection with that type of Elijah to the type that you have in your own life when you feel despairing. Also remember in Acts chapter 10, Cornelius, he was a Roman official, and he meets Peter for the first time. And knowing that Peter was an apostle, he falls at Peter's feet and begins to worship him. And Peter says, "Please stand, for I am a man just like you." And so when you read the narrative of Scripture, you find that though these people were heralded as some of the great leaders of the faith, had suffering and despair that often doesn't look any different than the suffering and despair that we experience in our own lives. They're really just people.
Comforting. I mean, you know, obviously we want to be able to identify with someone in the Bible. You know that, you know, I'm not weird. I'm not the only one. I mean, obviously we can identify with people today because we're all struggling. But when you look at heroes of the Bible, I think that gives us faith that we can get through this. You know, and the Lord can get us through it.
And a real quick one about even the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul said, "I don't want you to be unaware of the suffering that we experienced in Asia." And he said that we despaired even life, and the sentence of death was upon us, so that we might come to trust in God who raises the dead and not in men. So even there you have the Apostle Paul describing his experience with suffering to a degree of despairing life. So when you think of depression, depression is a despairing of life. And in some sense, a desire for death rather than life. And then in some serious cases, the person doesn't feel anything. A desire for life or death is really not a desire at all. But even there, you have the Apostle Paul really giving words to the experience that's often found in mental illness.
Hey, Chris, while we're on the sort of the same topic, can you speak to how sin specifically relates to mental illness?
Sure. I'll speak to this and let you guys share too. So oftentimes in the church, in Western evangelicalism, sin is often seen as the cause of mental illness. And though sin is the cause of human suffering that we read in Genesis chapter 3, as a result of sin, suffering was the consequence, both for the serpent, for man, for woman, and even for Christ, that even the serpent would bruise him. And that suffering is the natural consequence of sin for all. But sin in someone's life doesn't necessarily cause depression, not in all cases. You have plenty of biblical examples where people were despairing, like Job. Job, if you were to hear a Job in chapter 3 in your small group, you would probably think this person is pretty troubled when you read Job 3. And Job's suffering and despair was not caused by any personal sin at all. It actually says, God said, Job was a righteous man, he feared God, he shunned evil and had integrity in all of his ways. And that suffering was a cause of God's will. That his despair was a result of God's will, not sin. But I do think that because sin is what causes human suffering in general, that sort of the evil behind the mask, right, of what is all human suffering is a result of sin. But someone that's sitting in front of me in my office that says, I feel depressed, I'm not going to automatically think that they have some grave moral sin in their life. And that if I somehow discover what that is, then I can say, oh, yeah, no wonder you have depression. But in some cases, someone can be in grave sin and in rebellion against the Lord. And if that is the case, that could be a cause of depression, but not always. So I think we've got to be very careful with that.
I think a lot of times what people do if they've sinned, they hang on to that and they maybe pull shame on themselves, or even their Christian friends or somebody will shame them, and they then identify, I am bad, whereas, you know, a more healthier approach, I guess, would be guilt, and then I'm guilty of did I am responsible for doing this, and I shouldn't have done it. But redemption is, I'm going to not do this anymore. I'm sorry for this, and I go on. And, you know, by grace, I am now, you know, I'm redeemed, and you can go forward. So, you know, don't identify as I am bad, I have done bad things, and I can go forward from there.
Yeah, and I think just the, you know, obviously, if you are willfully sinning, then there should be that level of, at some point, you need to come to a recognition, and you do go through that shame and guilt. And because as human as we are and as Christ-like as we want to be, there are times when we make decisions that are clearly not good decisions. And I think Christ keeping us on track is that process of kind of that shame and guilt of, I did make a bad decision. I did choose to sin. And then coming full circle, acknowledging that and confessing that. And I think we all start over. I remember my husband every day would, you know, Jesus come into my life and save me. And I'm like, you're saved. And he's like, I know I'm saved, but, you know, I need renewal every day. And the reality is we do. We need renewal every day.
Were there any more that you wanted to touch on?
Not right now.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to kind of go a different direction, but can you kind of, just for everyone's information, kind of break down the whole gamut of, I mean, people talk about psychiatrists, psychologists, licensed counselor. Who do they go see? I mean, if they, let's say someone's feeling depressed, or maybe they're just dealing with, they realize they have trauma they have not dealt with, or whatever. What do they do? Where do they go? And what's the order? I mean, kind of break that down a little bit.
I'll start with, kind of at the top of the list, I put a psychiatrist. That's a medical doctor. They have an MD, and they are the ones who can diagnose, and they are the only ones that can prescribe medications in terms of psychological. Any medical doctor can prescribe meds.
But they typically do the counseling also?
Very few psychiatrists probably spend more than 5 or 10 minutes with the person, and they'll go.
So you're basically, if you want medication, you're seeing two doctors.
You're going to see a psychiatrist for medication, and then you're probably going to see a counselor
to
talk it out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Then there's a psychologist. Those are PhDs, and in Texas they're licensed. They can diagnose, and they do provide the counseling. So they'll do regular counseling. A licensed professional counselor, an LPC, they can diagnose and provide counseling. They're usually master's level people. That's what I have, and licensed through the state of Texas, and usually just provide, you know, one-on-one counseling. Then there's a licensed marriage and family counselor. So that's a licensure in Texas. Again, that's usually master's level, and they can diagnose and provide counseling. A licensed clinical social worker, so that's somebody who's gotten a social work degree and they've gone a clinical route, so they have done all the things that they're supposed to do, and again, licensed through Texas. Then there's the medical doctor, your GP, so that's probably the easiest one to access if you want medications. Some of them are having more awareness now about depression and domestic violence, and they'll ask questions, are you afraid of anybody in your house, or, you know, being more specific now and aware of what could be going on with people, so they can prescribe meds. And so any of these can be biblically based counselors. So just remember, find somebody that you're comfortable with. You are paying them for a service, and if you don't like what they're saying or their perspective, then you can, you know, go somewhere else. Now, if you keep going and shopping and, you know, then
name's
going to
be on the list.
You might start looking this way instead of, but anyway.
So you mentioned domestic violence. You mentioned that several times as we've met together. And so what's the connection there? What specifically made you bring that up?
Yes, I was going to mention that earlier when we were talking about the diagnosing. So I worked with victims of domestic violence at Friends of the Family for a long time. And there's just time after time where people who live in that situation end up getting diagnosed with things because they live in fear, not because there's anything really wrong with them. So that's just something to keep in mind, that if you can be diagnosed bipolar, but if you're living in a situation that's crazy making, then there's a reason why you're doing that. And it's more about survival that you're doing some of those things rather than there's anything really wrong with you.
I just want to jump backwards a little bit.
Other than something really wrong with you that needs to be diagnosed, but maybe you still need counseling.
Yes. It doesn't mean that you wouldn't want counseling, but you're not clinically depressed or,
Just the backwards I want to jump is we obviously, people click and don't click, and you usually know first or second time you meet with someone. So if you do meet with a counselor, and it just doesn't, it's just not right for whatever reason, and there doesn't have to be anything concrete. You know, they can have, I don't know, purple hair, and you just, purple hair is not your thing or whatever. The point is don't give up at that point. Don't say, well, counseling's not for me because ... You know, it may take a second or third time to find someone that just get your story. And sometimes you need and want empathy. Not every counselor is going to be a victim of domestic violence or this or that. But there are a lot of counselors out there that are very empathetic, that have walked that journey, whether it's living on the streets or so there's someone out there for you to talk to that can help you through what's going on in your life. So just don't give up when you meet one or two and go, it's not working.
And they don't necessarily have to have experienced what you have experienced in order to be able to be helpful.
Right.
Yeah.
So that kind of leads me, your answer or your comment leads me to the next question. What's my role? Let's say I am struggling. And what's my role? And then maybe if I know someone that's struggling, what's their role? So that's a big question, and so anybody can answer it, but I'll start with you, Shereen.
Me?
Yep.
Okay. I guess hopefully you're involved in a church. There's friends, and you can approach them, and you might just need somebody to listen. And so as a counselor, I've, you know, gone through all the classes, and I know that if there's a loss, there's going to be grief. But even though I know that, it doesn't keep me from going through that process. So when my husband passed away, I knew there was going to be grief, and I was going to be forgetful. I locked myself out of my car about twice in 3 months, and I never did that. So I had to just say, this is normal for what's going on with me. And I did seek help. I did talk to people. And if you feel like you need somebody professional, there's the different churches have, hopefully, some have counseling centers. And I know Denton has, there are several biblically centered, like the Refuge, I guess, and I wasn't really aware of them before a month or two ago. Yeah, so that's great. Your doctors may have referrals, and I don't know. There's a lot, and I don't want to say just Google, but there's a lot of hotlines available. So if you've got a teenager struggling with something, there's hotlines or things that are anonymous so that they can just call and talk to, and you as a parent may not want you to be the first person that they're going to go to. So, but as a friend, and Tammy can talk a little bit more about this too, is just to listen, mm-hmm. is to be empathetic and to listen. And a lot of times if you hold on to something and keep it inside, you're giving it power. And when you just let it go, you're taking away its power by just putting it out there and just let the Holy Spirit come in you and get the other stuff out.
I think from my perspective as an office manager and just having people come in and in that raw state of I'm in crisis right now, and if I don't see someone tomorrow, I'm going to get a divorce or my kid's going to do this or this is going to happen. The things that I would recommend they do is, because 9 times out of 10, you can't get someone in that quick because all the other people that are being seen have been at that crisis point. I would recommend, obviously, that they pray about it, but that they would make a list and of things that they could do. And the thing that also served as, is when you do meet with a counselor, it helps you focus. Because a lot of times when you meet with a counselor, the first probably 30 minutes is, my name's Sally, my name's George, you go through this whole process of kind of just getting to know each other. And when you write these things down, you can get to the point. And the joke was, is you'll kind of get more bang for your buck. You know, you're not spending the first hour for $75 just chit-chatting. Not that that's what counselors do, but you do have to get familiar with someone. I mean, most normal people don't come in and just pour their hearts out to someone they've never met before. So organize your thoughts, organize your feelings on paper. So when you do see someone, and it doesn't have to be the counselor, it can be when you talk to your friend, when you talk to a pastor, when you talk to someone else, that you're just organized in your thought and your process, and you... It seems to give more flow to what you're thinking, because you can write things down and go, that's irrational. I know that's irrational. And then you can go, but this is real. This is really what's happening. A lot of times when people would come in, and you get this a lot, my teenager needs counseling. Your teenager probably does need counseling. But getting that teenager to come in for counseling is probably not going to happen, or not willfully. But we can help you cope with that, and we can help you have things ready when your teenager says, you know, maybe I do need to talk to someone. So just kind of be organized in thoughts and plan ahead, and don't just let your emotions just completely take over in your life and just process.
I'm a verbal processor, and my son's a verbal processor. Bless my husband's heart. He has to listen to us process all the time. So we journal a lot, both of us. We're writing everything down, because if you saw the mess that my mind is, you would wonder how I can survive. But if I write it out, I can put order to all of this mess that's going on up here. So that's really good advice. Do you have anything to add to either of those?
Sure. Can you say the question one more time for me?
Yes. So what responsibility, what is my role as someone that needs help, and from whatever range of issues that I'm struggling with, or what is my role as a friend or a family member of someone that I see is struggling?
And actually, Mark, if you could... touch on the second part of that. We had quite a few questions from people about how to deal with people who are suffering from various types of mental illnesses.
Were they listed? Like, specific things were listed?
Yeah, so it's everything from, like, somebody who's in a cycle of depression and can't get out, to someone who's bipolar. And then the questions range from, like, how do you intervene and help them, especially if someone's in a crisis mode and has made comments about suicide, but you're not sure to believe them, or people who you think are maybe just using mental illness to manipulate the situation. So you want to just talk a little bit about how you involve yourself with those people?
Yeah, maybe we can go back down.
Yeah,
When you ask the question of what role do I have as one who is suffering, can be very difficult to discern when you're suffering, especially with things like bipolar or I remember when I was a kiddo, so when I was 9, I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder. I was also diagnosed with manic depressant, so I was just kind of all over the map. And I was 9, and just went into my teens, like, I had no grid to understand any of that at all. And a lot of times people that I'm meeting with, they don't really know what to do at all. And I would say that kind of, what is your responsibility if you are the one who's experiencing this? I would just simply say that your responsibility, especially, let's say that you're a Christian, if we even have a category for Christians with mental illness, the responsibility that you would have is really beginning to come to the Lord with that. That doesn't mean that you don't seek out a professional, you don't seek out help, but I think what would be good for the person to learn, and this is something that eventually in counseling I kind of get to, I don't start there, but get there eventually, is they need to learn, the sufferer, all of us as sufferers, as co-sufferers, as fellow sufferers, we need to learn how to connect to the living God as the Psalms do. Because you can find that the suffering of mental illness, my responsibility as a Christian, if I am suffering with that, is to connect to my God, to connect to the living God with my lament, with my sorrow, with my request, with my despair, with my anger, with my doubts and my fears and my worries, with my supplications, with my desires, my wants. Like, connect to the living God with all of that. And that's what you see in the Psalms. And so, but someone who is a non-Christian, I think that their responsibility is really to themselves, learning how to share that you need help, learning how to communicate that and who to communicate that to. Maybe a little different with now I know someone who is suffering, maybe a relative, a friend, a spouse, grandchild, like whoever that may be. Again, your responsibility to move toward them as a believer in Jesus Christ. Like when you look in the Bible, God is a God who sees trouble and he also enters in and he invites conversation. He listens and he speaks. You see the same with the ministry of Christ, and really the commission is the church, that we're called to see trouble, to see it, enter in. So enter into someone's life and begin talking to him. Like, there's a church here, you know, maybe there's a new guy's coming in. He seems a little distant. He's kind of isolates. He didn't really talk to people. And it just looks like that maybe he's having a hard time, like he's going through a lot. You just walk across the room and say, "Hey, man, I don't believe we met. What's your name?" And start talking. And you see, God does that.
Do you feel like we're afraid to do that?
I think so.
Christians are afraid to do that.
I think we're just uncomfortable, a lot of us, in our own skin.
And it gets messy. It can get messy, and then we don't want mess in our life.
Right, and that's just another thing where, as Christians and as the church, we don't know how to handle this. We don't know how to handle mental illness. We don't know how to think about it. We don't know what to do. We don't know how to handle addiction. But we see a God in the Bible. We see Jesus in the Bible. We see them seeing and entering in. And he calls us to do that, whether or not you consider your professional or not. That we're called to enter into people's lives. We're called to walk it with people, be in their life, inviting conversation, listening well, and then as God would have us speak, speaking. And I think that that's our responsibility as followers of Jesus, is to be entering into the sorrows and troubles of people's life, wherever God would have us do that and how God would have us do that. And so I think that the Bible gives us that insight and that understanding, how to do that as followers of Christ, how to do that as professionals, all in our other circles and other areas of influence, and however we can.
I think it's important as a friend to someone. I can remember something that was really profound because my husband talked about killing himself a lot, and nobody lives with that. I mean, not everybody lives with that, and it's a hard place to be, and you get tired of hearing it. And one of the ladies who had come in for counseling, so you get kind of callous to it, I guess. And a lady had come in who'd been in and out for counseling, and her husband did kill himself. And within a week or two, everybody's like, "Well, she's in a good mood." And I'm like, you don't know the pressure that she's been under for the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. You can't have a knife in the house. You can't have anything bigger than string in the house. You can't, I mean, all of this almost oppression of being within that situation. And I felt like for her that the people who should have been stepping up to the plate and being her friend were dogging her. And remember, people who are going through tough times with either a spouse or a child or it's not just the person who's talking about suicide that's suffering or that's having problems. It's their spouse. It's their children. I mean, this guy's kid found him. He was going to start his first day of high school, and the daughter was getting ready to go off to college, and he killed himself. And it's just a horrible thing. It was a horrible event. It's when my husband, they ruled his death a suicide. And you hesitate to say this to very many people, but there's a bit of a peace because it's over. It's over for them because they've been suffering with this. And it's over for you. It's over for your daughter. Is he going to ever walk her down the aisle? He's not. But she's not going to go to school and say, my daddy's a drug addict, or my daddy's in jail, or my daddy's this. So you balance that, but just you need to be a friend to people.
Thank you for sharing that.
What do you do specifically if you know someone really needs to go see a counselor, but they won't go, they refuse to go, they say, I don't need to go, but you know just by being a friend that they really need to see a counselor? How do you handle that or respond to them?
Well, hopefully, I mean, there's the side of they're actively suicidal or something where you would have to try to have an intervention. But somebody had said this to me one time, and there's like three kinds of friends. There's a friend who listens, a friend who distracts, and a friend who does. And so you can figure out you're either all those things for somebody, or maybe you're just one of them. But, you know, whatever you can do, you just be there. Because you can't make that person want to do something different. But knowing eventually when that point maybe comes for them that you're available.
And what if someone has said they're going to commit suicide and you feel like they mean it, or they're very serious about it, and you feel like it's time to get help? Who do you call when someone says, I'm going to commit suicide, and you believe them to be authentic? Who do you call? Who do you reach out to?
Well, there's two things. One is, if somebody said that in my office as an LPC, I have to report that. I mean, I have
report
to...
Report it, too.
I guess the police, and let them know to go out and do a welfare check. So there's a mental health unit with either the sheriff's office or the county, yeah, and they will go out and do a welfare check for you on somebody. If you know somebody in that family, you know, husband, wife, sister, brother, whatever, try to contact them. Hopefully maybe you know them well enough that you know that there's somebody else you can call in.
And usually universities have a hotline that you can call as someone... You know, right. Even if you're not the one person, you can call the hotline as a roommate or, right. You know, and say, this is what I've heard from my
yes.
roommate or something like that.
Right, right. So just as a, you know, for anybody else that's not, you can still call the police department. You can still ask for a mental health checkup or, yeah.
I think also on the ground, if you have someone that, personally, everyone out here, I would have the name of a counselor, a counseling center, that when someone comes to you in crisis, that you can say, you know, maybe you should go talk to the center, the refuge center. Maybe you should go talk to...
It's First Refuge. They're right across the street from First Baptist Church is where First Refuge is.
First Denton. First Baptist Denton.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Denton. And so I would have that information available. I'd have the phone number. Frankly, I'd have it on my refrigerator memorized. You know, just call these people, 387, and just be ready, because you never know when somebody's, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink.
Right.
But 5 minutes later, their head's drinking. You know, you just need to be ready when somebody needs help.
In our church office, I mean, most of you know one of our cell phone numbers, one of the staff members' cell phone numbers, or the church office number. And we have plenty of resources. Mm-hmm. And so that's always an option as well.
You know, and another thing is to maybe gather some literature about some of the different issues with the numbers, and then you have the brochures, and you can just say, well, I know you're not interested right now, but here's something you can have for later. And eventually they may have so many of them that they pick one up and look at it or something.
Yeah, I'd like to answer, you know, part of your question. You could also call UBH mm-hmm. if you really know that someone, you really feel like they're a risk, a threat to themselves or a threat to someone else. You can call UBH. First Refuge Ministries, where I'm the counseling director, we provide free counseling. So we have lots of professional counselors, people that are licensed, that work at our office, that volunteer in our office. We're doing about $30,000 worth of free counseling a month right now, so about 250 hours of free counseling. So it's a great resource. And you're asking the question, like, what do you do when someone doesn't want to get help? That's tough. especially that's why what was being said is that hopefully in a case like that, you have a reason to intervene. But when you don't have that, you don't really know. And I love that you said the idea of being a friend makes me think of Solomon, and the Proverbs says, there is a friend that loves at all times, but a brother is born for adversity. And what he means by that is that your family members are born for the adversity in your life. So when you get in a car accident, you get sick, or you got to get your appendix taken out, you got your families there, and they might be there, but they don't like you, right? Like, not all family members, like each other. And so what Solomon is trying to highlight is that there is a friend that loves at all times. That friend that when you're in the car, the radio's off, there's no music, no talking, and you're just content. Like, just this mutual understanding of, this is okay. Or like, when everything is going wrong, when things are horrible, when things are good, like, they're just that friend. And I think that that is a wisdom for us as a church, especially in the category of mental illness, is to learn how to be that friend that just loves patiently, enduringly, lovingly, redemptively, just loves and watches and waits. And so, but that's a lot easier said than done, right? That love costs, and it hurts, and it's sacrificial, and that it oftentimes takes time.
Well, there's also prayer. And so you can call somebody else who's a friend and say, please pray with me for so-and-so. They don't have to know that person, but, you know, that's a way of kind of taking care of yourself, too, when this is going on, is to, you know, pray and gather others around you to help you.
I want to make sure. There's a couple questions that I want to touch on, if that's okay. Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay.
What time is it?
Yeah, we're out of time.
It's
8:10. Okay.
Go ahead.
These questions kind of all relate. So if you could talk a little bit about kind of the cycles of depression, like how it manifests itself in someone and kind of the highs and lows, and someone referenced specifically being lost and feeling empty. Someone wanted to know if there's something they can do physically themselves, or if there was something they should have done that they didn't, which has caused their mental illness or can cure their mental illness, and then how that relates to using medicine and intervening in those kind of situations. So that's a lot, but...
I'll jump on that real quick. I love that what Tammy was saying about medication, especially with Christians. A lot of times Christians will see that medication is a lack of faith and that taking medication is somehow sinful. And that can be true. It depends on the heart. So if a person is taking medication in a way where their heart is not reliant at all on Christ, then that is wrong. But you can also have a Christian who says, I'm not taking medication. I'm not going to take it. I don't care. And if taking medication will help them love God, love their family, love the people around them better, then they should take it. And it is actually sinful that they don't. Mm-hmm. So you can be just as sinful eating a taco as you can taking medication. It's really irrelevant. It's really the heart behind it. What is motivating this? If it is to love God and love my wife, then I will take this medication to help me do that. We can rely on things, all kinds of things. We can rely on our bank accounts. We can rely on people's praise and acceptance of us more than Christ. And all of that is wrong, just like it can be with medication. But I do think that that's the far swing to the other side, is Christians just assume that that's not trusting in Christ. But you can take medication and trust in the Lord. And sometimes that might be needed in certain cases with severe depression, where the medication actually gets them to a point to where they can do counseling. Mm-hmm. it kind of stabilizes them at the point to where they can actually hear maybe the gospel being applied with a skilled counselor to their heart. But if they're not on that kind of medication, and then trying to do, perform counseling and therapy might be just be impossible. And so the different degrees of depression is really complex. Like, for example, someone can say, I just lost my job and I'm depressed, or I just lost my girlfriend and I'm depressed. And that depression is really a description of like the circumstances gone wrong. And we use that kind of language a lot. Like, I feel depressed because everything's falling apart. When in a lot of cases, that's not perhaps depression. It's maybe the experience of what it maybe feels like, but not real depression. It's a lot different to hear someone say, I can't be in relationships because I'm depressed. I can't keep a job because I'm depressed. I can't eat because I'm depressed. You hear the difference? Mm-hmm. That things are going wrong because I am this way, rather than things are going on and I feel this way. And so the different levels of severity, I would say that if someone is not able to eat, they can't take care of themselves, they can't bathe, they can't keep a job, they can't function at all, then that's pretty severe. But yeah, the various shades of it can range from very subtle, to which we all experience what might feel like depression and is depression in the experiential sense. And then there can be the very severe type of depression where you lose all hope, all motivation, all feeling, and you literally can't function at all. And so there can be a wide range between the two of those.
And just quickly, if you're, because I've had time, and we talked briefly when we met about the difference between depression and anxiety, and I went to a doctor, just my general doctor, and I said, everything on paper is great. My job's good. I love my job. Financially, things are great. But I'm just on edge, and I want to choke somebody. And I know that's not right. I know that's not a good thing. But I'm just, you know, just always, like, a lot of times I'm on edge. And so she prescribed some medication that was, and I read the bottle, and it says for depression. And I'm like, I'm not depressed. I'm just on edge. There's a lot of anxiety and depression, at least on that first level, really tie in together, especially the medications for that can treat both. So don't feel like, I mean, at first I was like, don't label me as depressed. I'm not depressed. I mean, things are good. I just want to hurt somebody. That's all. I think that's self-aware, and that you say something to someone. Like, I said something to a doctor before I hurt somebody. I'm not on that medication now, but sometimes you just need that edge. So don't look too close. Don't get too close. Things are good now. I mean, you know, and sometimes you just need things for a period of time. It's not forever. You just need kind of help over that edge, but don't be afraid to take things. Don't see yourself as labeled. Don't think it's eternal. That was one of my husband's thing, is if he didn't get sleep one night, it was like he was never going to get sleep ever the rest of his life. And I'm like, it's one night, you know. So when you do deal with depression, it is really different, though, when you get in that deep, dark hole of depression, to see out over the edge. And if you're in that deep, dark hole, then I would say immediately seek help. Go talk to a doctor, even if it's your general practitioner. Go talk to someone. It's not likely that you're going to get out of that hole on your own. Seek help.
Yeah, and so it is shown that having counseling along with medications is very effective. So sometimes you just might need a little bit of, you know, medication, and it's good. But counseling by itself, if things are really off, isn't going to be helpful. So the two together, a lot of times, is a much better thing. And you don't always know. It's just going to take time, especially with more normal grief and things like that. Because I know that after Dave died for a year, I knew, even when I was feeling down, that that's what this was about. But I was still going to have to go through it. I was still going to have to experience it. So it's not going to go away. And then, you know, a year later, I had talked to a lady, and she was like, yeah, my husband died, and, you know, but I'm feeling a lot better now. And I said, well, when was that? And she was, oh, about 5 years ago. And I'm like, you know, it's been 3 months. I still feel like I'm in the middle of the whole thing, you know. So when you're in the middle of something, sometimes you can't see the end of it. But I can tell you that a year later and 5 years later and now almost 10 years later, it's better.
If I can, just real quick, there's something really important that I think I want to share on that topic. And you're talking about just hearing this lady 5 years later, just still just really battling the loss. I think of how as Christians, and just using depression as an example, where depression can be so intense, so encompassing, so overwhelming, so consuming, that it just feels as if that your suffering means that you have no faith. You know what I'm talking about? That I'm suffering with this because I lack faith in God. And I think in the church, we will say things like that, especially regarding depression, that if somehow the person can invigorate or find faith, then their suffering will begin to subside. And what's interesting is in Psalm 88, which if you look that up later, maybe when you get home, Psalm 88 is the miriest psalm of all of the Bible. It ends with no light at the tunnel. It ends with the psalmist saying, my companions are nothing but darkness. And he associated that his social interactions with people were just darkness. And what's interesting is in that psalm, three different places he says, God, I cry out to you. Day and night. He refers to God as his God of salvation, and then he says, I pray to you continually. But the description of his despair is unbelievable. The idea of being in death or being sealed off from God, the anger of God against him, and that in his depression, feeling that God is now an enemy, but praying. What's interesting is the psalm is always moving in God's direction. And so when you think of Hebrews chapter 11, which is sort of this biblical description of faith, Hebrews 11 says that without faith, it's impossible to please God. For those who come to him must believe that he exists and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him diligently. So what is biblical faith? Well, it's seeking and crying out to God continually. So when you see Psalm 88, you see depression, despair, agony, but you see biblical faith. And so what I wanted to share, the reason why I want to share that is that it can be possible for you to suffer with depression for whatever reason and be full of faith. That there is a category for that in the Bible. And so you see that with Psalm 88, the continual crying out to God, which is biblical faith. He believed that God existed, and he sought him diligently. And so to know that, that a person can have heroic faith and suffer with depression.
Okay, so we're going to close, but I'm probably going to stumble over my words here a little bit, but I've never struggled with depression. I've never been diagnosed as bipolar. You know, so I can't identify with that. I don't understand it in my head. I can understand it by talking to you, and so, but I've never experienced it. And so, I know that there's others that are in that exact same place. And so, I think we have to take responsibility when we haven't handled it well. For those who have struggled, or we haven't understood or had compassion as we should. And I think we need to take responsibility if we have possibly failed in those areas with the people that we love. And ask God to give us compassion and ask God to give us understanding and eyes that we don't have because we're not struggling. But that's with anything, not just this issue. It's with anything. And so I want to close in prayer with that.